side of Catherine Russell Drive. 10. Jenny was at the hospital, of course. She would give Mrs. Covland's new bundle of joy a final weigh-in before sending them home. The receptionist on duty at the health center was 17-year-old Gina Buffalino, who had exactly 6 weeks' worth of medical experience. As a candy striper, she gave Rusty a deer-in-the-headlights look when he came in that made his heart sink. But the waiting room was empty, and that was a good thing. A very good thing. Any call-ins? Rusty asked.
One. Mrs. Venziano, out on the Blackridge Road. Her baby got his head caught between the bars of his playpen. She wanted an ambulance. I told her to grease the kid's head up with olive oil and see if she could get him out that way. It worked.
Rusty grinned. Maybe there was hope for this kid yet. Gina, looking divinely relieved, grinned back.
Place is empty, at least, Rusty said, which is great.
Not quite. Ms. Grinnell is here. Andrea, I put her in three.
Gina hesitated.
She seemed pretty upset.
Rusty's heart, which had begun to rise, sank back down again. Andrea Grinnell, and upset, which meant she wanted a bump on her OxyContin prescription, which he in all good conscience could not give, even supposing Andy Sanders had enough stock to fill it.
Okay.
He started down the hall to exam room three, then stopped and looked back.
You didn't page me.
Gina flushed.
She asked me specifically not to?
This puzzled Rusty, but only for a second. Andrea might have a pill problem, but she was no dummy. She'd known that if Rusty was over at the hospital, he was probably with Twitch. And Dougie Twitchell happened to be her baby brother, who even at the age of 39 must be protected from the evil facts of life. Rusty stood at the door with the black three decaled on it, trying to gather himself. This was going to be hard. Andrea wasn't one of the defiant boozers he saw who claimed that alcohol formed absolutely no part of their problems. Nor was she one of the meth heads who had been showing up with increasing frequency over the last year or so. Andrea's responsibility for her problem was more difficult to pinpoint, and that complicated the treatment. Certainly she'd been in agony after her fall. Oxy had been the best thing for her, allowing her to cope with the pain so she could sleep and begin therapy. It wasn't her fault that the drug which allowed her to do those things was the one doctors sometimes called hillbilly heroin. He opened the door and went in, rehearsing his refusal. Kind but firm, he told himself. Kind but firm. She was sitting in the corner chair under the cholesterol poster, knees together, head bowed over the purse in her lap. She was a big woman, who now looked small, diminished somehow. When she raised her head to look at him and he saw how haggard her face was, the lines bracketing her mouth deep, the skin under her eyes almost black, he changed his mind and decided to write the script on one of Dr. Haskell's pink pads after all. Maybe after the dome crisis was over, he'd try to get her into a detox program, threatened to tattle to her brother if that was what it took. Now, however, he would give her what she needed, because he had rarely seen need so stark.
Eric. Rusty. I'm in trouble.
I know, I can see it. I'll write you a...
No.
She was looking at him with something like horror.
Not even if I beg. I am a drug addict, and I have to get off. I'm just a darn old junkie.
Her face folded in on itself. She tried to will it straight again and couldn't. She put her hands over it instead. Big, wrenching sobs that were hard to listen to came through her fingers. Rusty went to her, going down on one knee and putting an arm around her. Andrea, it's good that you want to stop. Excellent, but this might not be the best time. She looked at him with streaming, reddened eyes.
You're right about that. It's the worst time, but it has to be now. And you mustn't tell Dougie or Rose. Can you help me? Can it even be done? Because I haven't been able to. Not on my own. Those hateful pink pills. I put them in the medicine cabinet and say no more today, and an hour later I'm taking them down again. I've never been in a mess like this, not in my whole life.
She dropped her voice as if confiding a great secret.
I don't think it's my back anymore. I think it's my brain telling my back to hurt, so I can go on taking those damn pills.
Why now, Andrea?
She only shook her head.
Can you help me or not?
Yes, but if you're thinking about going cold turkey, don't. For one thing, you're apt to. For a brief moment, he saw Jenny, shaking in her bed, muttering about the great pumpkin. You're apt to have seizures. She either didn't register that or set it aside.
How long?
To get past the physical part? 2 weeks. Maybe three. And that's putting you on the fast track, he thought, but didn't say. She gripped his arm. Her hand was very cold.
Too slow.
An exceedingly unpleasant idea surfaced in Rusty's mind. Probably just transient paranoia brought on by stress, but persuasive. Andrea, is someone blackmailing you?
Are you kidding? Everyone knows I take those pills. It's a small town.
Which did not, in Rusty's opinion, actually answer the question.
What's the absolute shortest it can take?
With B12 shots plus thiamine and vitamins, you might manage it in 10 days, but you'd be miserable. You wouldn't be able to sleep much, and you'll have restless leg syndrome. Not mild either, they don't call it kicking the habit for nothing. And you'd have to have someone administer the step-down dosage, someone who can hold the pills and won't give them to you when you ask. Because you will.
10 days.
She looked hopeful.
And this might be over by then anyway, yes? This dome thing?
Maybe this afternoon, that's what we all hope.
10 days,
she said. 10 days. And, he thought, you'll want those goddamn things for the rest of your life. But this he didn't say aloud either. 11. Sweetbriar Rose had been extraordinarily busy for a Monday morning. But, of course, there had never been a Monday morning like this in the town's history. Still, the patrons had left willingly enough when Rose announced the grill was closed and wouldn't reopen until 5 that afternoon.
And by then maybe you can all go over to Moxie's in Castle Rock and eat there, she finished. That had brought spontaneous applause, even though Moxie's was a famously filthy grease pit.
No lunch? Ernie Calvert asked.
Rose looked at Barbie, who raised his hands to his shoulders. Don't ask me.
Sandwiches, Rose said, until they're gone.
This had brought more applause. People seemed surprisingly upbeat this morning. There had been laughter and raillery. Perhaps the best sign of the town's improved mental health was at the rear of the restaurant, where the bullshit table was back in session. The TV over the counter, now locked on CNN, was a big part of the reason. The talking heads had little more to broadcast than rumors, but most were hopeful. Several scientists who'd been interviewed said the cruise had a good chance of smashing through and ending the crisis. One estimated the chances of success as better than 80%. But, of course, he's at MIT in Cambridge, Barbie thought. He can afford optimism. Now, as he scraped the grill, a knock came at the door. Barbie looked around and saw Julia Shumway with 3 children clustered around her. They made her look like a junior high school teacher on a field trip. Barbie went to the door, wiping his hands on his apron.
If we let everyone in who wants to eat, we'll be out of food in no time, Anson said irritably from where he was swabbing down tables.
Rose had gone back to Food City to try and purchase more meat. I don't think she wants to eat, Barbie said, and he was right about that.
Good morning, Colonel Barbara,
Julia said with her little Mona Lisa smile. I keep wanting to call you Major Barbara, like the play, I know. Barbie had heard this one a few times before, like 10,000. Is this your posse? One of the children was an extremely tall, extremely skinny boy with a mop of dark brown hair. One was a stocky young fellow wearing baggy shorts and a faded 50-cent t-shirt. The third was a pretty little girl with a lightning bolt on her cheek. A decal rather than a tattoo, but it still gave her a certain savoir-faire. He realized if he told her she looked like the middle school version of Joan Jett, she wouldn't know who he was talking about.
Nori Calvert, Julia said, touching the riot girl's shoulder. Benny Drake. And this tall drink of water is Joseph McClatchy. Yesterday's protest demonstration was his idea.
But I never meant anyone to get hurt, Joe said. And it wasn't your fault they did, Barbie told him, so rest easy on that.
Are you really the bull goose? Benny asked, looking him over.
Barbie laughed. No, he said, and I'm not even going to try and be the bull goose unless I absolutely have to.
But you know the soldiers out there, right? Nori asked.
Well, not personally. For one thing, they're Marines. I was Army.
You're still Army, according to Colonel Cox, Julia said. She was wearing her cool little smile, but her eyes were dancing with excitement. Can we talk to you? Young Mr. McClatchy has had an idea, and I think it's brilliant, if it works.
It'll work, Joe said. When it comes to computer shit stuff, I'm the bull goose.
Step into my office, Barbie said, and escorted them toward the counter. 12.
It was brilliant, all right. But it was already going on 10:30, and if they were really going to make this thing happen, they would have to move fast.
He turned to Julia. Do you have your cell... Julia slapped it smartly into his palm before he could finish. Cox's number is in memory.
Great, now if I knew how to access the memory.
Joe took the phone.
What are you, from the Dark Ages?
Yes, Barbie said, when knights were bold and ladies fair went without their underwear.
Nori laughed hard at that, and when she raised her fist, Barbie tapped her small fist with his big one.
Joe pushed a couple of buttons on the minuscule keypad. He listened, then handed the cell to Barbie. Cox must still have been sitting with one hand on the phone because he was already on when Barbie put Julia's cell to his ear.
How's it going, Colonel?
Cox asked.
We're basically okay. And that's a start.
Easy for you to say, Barbie thought.
I imagine things will remain basically okay until the missile either bounces off or punches through and does gross damage to the woods and farms on our side, which the citizens of Chester's Mill would welcome.
What are your guys saying?
Not much. No one is making any predictions.
That's not what we're hearing on the TV.
I don't have time to keep up with the talking heads.
Barbie could hear the shrug in Cox's voice.
We're hopeful. We think we've got a shot, to coin a phrase.
Julia was opening and closing her hands in a what gives gesture. Colonel Cox, I'm sitting here with four friends. One of them is a young man named Joe McClatchy, who's had a pretty cool idea. I'm going to put him on the phone with you right now. Joe was shaking his head hard enough to make his hair fly. Barbie paid no attention. To explain it. And he handed Joe the cell.
Talk, he said.
But...
Don't argue with the bull goose, son. Talk.
Joe did so, diffidently at first, with a lot of ahs and erms and you-knows. But as his idea took hold of him again, he sped up, became articulate. Then he listened. After a little while, he started to grin.
A few moments later, he said, "Yes, sir. Thank you, sir," and handed the phone back to Barbie. "Check it out. They're going to try to augment our Wi-Fi before they shoot the missile. Jesus, this is hot!"
Julia grabbed his arms, and Joe said, "I'm sorry, Ms. Shumway. I mean, jeepers."
"Never mind that. Can you really work this thing?"
"You kidding? No prob."
"Colonel Cox," Barbie asked, "is this true about the Wi-Fi?"
"We can't stop anything you folks want to try to do," Cox said. "I think you were the one who originally pointed that out to me, so we might as well help. You'll have the fastest internet in the world, at least for today." "That's some bright kid you got there, by the way."
"Yes, sir, that was my impression," Barbie said, and gave Joe a thumbs up. The kid was glowing.
Cox said, "If the boy's idea works and you record it, make sure we get a copy. We'll be making our own, of course, but the scientists in charge of this thing will want to see what the hit looks like from your side of the dome."
"I think we can do better than that," Barbie said. "If Joe here can put this together, I think most of the town will be able to watch it live."
This time Julia raised her fist, grinning. Barbie bumped it.
13.
"Holy shit," Joe said.
The awe on his face made him look 8 instead of 13. The whipcrack confidence was gone from his voice. He and Barbie were standing about 30 yards from where Little Bitch Road ran up against the dome. It wasn't the soldiers he was looking at, although they had turned around to observe. It was the warning band and the big red X sprayed on the dome that had fascinated him.
"They're moving their bivouac point, or whatever you call it," Julia said. "The tents are gone."
"Sure, in about..." Barbie looked at his watch. 90 minutes, it's going to get very hot over there. "Son, you better get to it." But now that they were actually out here on the deserted road, Barbie began to wonder if Joe could do what he had promised.
"Yeah, but do you see the trees?"
Barbie didn't understand at first. He looked at Julia, who shrugged. Then Joe pointed, and he saw. The trees on the Tarker's side of the dome were dancing in a moderate fall wind, shedding leaves in colorful bursts that fluttered down around the watching marine sentries. On the male side, the branches were barely moving, and most of the trees were still fully dressed. Barbie was pretty sure air was coming through the barrier, but not with any force. The dome was damping the wind. He thought of how he and Paul Gendron, the guy in the sea dog's cap, had come to the little stream and had seen the water piling up. Julia said, "The leaves over here, look." "I don't know." "Listless, somehow limp." "It's just because they've got a wind on their side and we've only got a puff of breeze," Barbie said, then wondered if that was really it. Or all of it. But what good did it do to speculate about the current air quality in Chester's Mill when there was nothing they could do about it? "Go on, Joe. Do your thing." They had swung by the McClatchy house in Julia's Prius to get Joe's power book. Mrs. McClatchy had made Barbie swear he would keep her son safe, and Barbie had so sworn. Now, Joe pointed at the road. "Here?" Barbie raised his hands to the side of his face and sighted at the red X. "Little to the left. Can you try it? See how it looks." "Yeah." Joe opened the power book and turned it on. The Mac power-up chime sounded as pretty as ever, but Barbie thought he had never seen anything quite so surreal as the silver computer sitting on the patched asphalt of Little Bitch Road with its screen up. It seemed to summarize the last 3 days perfectly. "Battery's fresh, so it should run for at least 6 hours," Joe said. "Won't it go to sleep?" Julia asked. Joe gave her an indulgent, "Mother, please," look. Then he turned back to Barbie. "If the missile roasts my pro, do you promise to buy me another one?" "Uncle Sam will buy you another one," Barbie promised. "I'll put in the requisition myself."
"Sweet!"
Joe bent over the power book. There was a little silver barrel mounted atop the screen. This, Joe had told them, was some current compu miracle called eyesight. He ran his finger over the computer's touchpad, hit enter, and suddenly the screen filled with a brilliant image of Little Bitch Road. From ground level, each little bump and irregularity in the tar looked like a mountain. At mid-range, Barbie could see the marine sentries up to their knees.
"Sir, does he have a picture, sir?" one of them asked.
Barbie looked up.
"Let's put it this way, Marine. If I was doing inspection, you'd be doing push-ups with my foot in your ass. There's a scuff on your left boot. Unacceptable in a non-combat assignment."
The Marine looked down at his boot, which was indeed scuffed. Julia laughed. Joe did not. He was absorbed.
"It's too low. Ms. Shumway, have you got something in the car we can use to..."
He raised his hand about 3 feet off the road.
"I do," she said. "And get me my little gym bag, please."
He fiddled some more with the power book, then held out his hand.
"Sell?"
Barbie handed it to him. Joe hit the tiny buttons with blinding speed. Then,
"Benny? Nori, okay. You guys there? Good. Never been in a beer joint before, I bet. You ready? Excellent. Stand by."
He listened, then grinned.
"Are you kidding? Dude, according to what I'm getting, the jack is awesome. They're blasting the Wi-Fi. Got a jet."
He snapped the phone closed and handed it back to Barbie. Julia came back with Joe's gym bag and a carton containing undistributed sheets of the Democrat Sunday Extra Edition. Joe set the power book on the carton. The sudden rise in the image from ground level made Barbie a bit dizzy. Then checked it and pronounced it totally rad. He rummaged in the gym bag, brought out a black box with an antenna, and plugged it into the computer. The soldiers were clustered on their side of the dome, watching with interest. "Now I know how a fish feels in an aquarium," Barbie thought.
"Looks okay," Joe murmured. "I got a green bulb."
"Shouldn't you call your..." "If it's working, they'll call me," Joe said. Then,
"Uh-oh. This could be trouble."
Barbie thought he was referring to the computer, but the boy wasn't even looking at it. Barbie followed his gaze and saw the green chief of police car. It wasn't moving fast, but the bubblegums were pulsing. Pete Randolph got out from behind the wheel, emerging from the passenger side. The cruiser rocked a little when his weight left the springs. came Big Jim Rennie.
"Just what in the heck do you think you're doing?" he asked.
The phone in Barbie's hand buzzed. He handed it to Joe without taking his eyes from the approaching selectman and chief of police. 14. The sign over the door of Dippers said, "Welcome to the biggest dance floor in Maine." And for the first time in the Roadhouse's history, that floor was crowded at 11:45 in the morning. Tommy and Willow Anderson greeted people at the door as they arrived, a little like ministers welcoming parishioners to church. In this case, the first church of rock bands direct from Boston. At first, the audience was quiet, because there was nothing on the big screen but one blue word. Waiting. Benny and Nori had plugged in their equipment and switched the TV's feed to input 4. Then, suddenly, Little Bitch Road appeared in living color, complete with brightly colored leaves swirling down around the marine sentries. The crowd broke into applause and cheers. Benny gave Nori a high five, but that wasn't enough for Nori. She kissed him on the mouth, and hard. It was the happiest moment of Benny's life, even better than staying vertical while doing a full pipe roughie.
"Call him," Nori demanded.
"Right on," Benny said.
His face felt as if it might actually catch fire and burn, but he was grinning. He punched redial and held the phone to his ear.
"Dude, we got it. The picture's so radical, it..."
Joe cut him off.
"Houston, we have a problem."
15.
"I don't know what you folks think you're doing," Chief Randolph said, "but I want an explanation, and that thing's shut down until I get one."
He pointed at the power book.
"Pardon me, sir," one of the Marines said.
He was wearing a second lieutenant's stripes.
"That's Colonel Barbara, and he has official government sanction for this operation."
To this, Big Jim offered his most sarcastic smile. A vein in his neck was throbbing.
"This man is a colonel of nothing but troublemakers. He cooks in the local restaurant."
"Sir, my orders..."
Big Jim shook his finger at the second lieutenant.
"In Chester's Mill, the only official government we're recognizing right now is our own soldier, and I am its representative."
He turned to Randolph.
"Chief, if that kid won't turn it off, pull the plug."
"It has no plug that I can see," Randolph said. He was looking from Barbie to the Marine second lieutenant to Big Jim. He had begun to sweat.
"Then put a boot through the darn screen, just kill it."
Randolph stepped forward. Joe, looking scared but determined, stepped in front of the power book on the carton. He still had the cell phone in his hand.
"You better not. It's mine, and I'm not breaking any laws."
"Get back, Chief," Barbie said. "That's an order. If you still recognize the government of the country you live in, you'll obey it." Randolph looked around.
"Jim, maybe..."
"Maybe nothing," Big Jim said. "Right now, this is the country you live in. Kill that cotton-picking computer."
Julia stepped forward, grabbed the power book, and turned it so that the eye-vision camera was taking in the new arrivals. Tendrils of hair had escaped her businesslike bun and hung against her pink cheeks. Barbie thought she looked extraordinarily beautiful.
"Ask Nori if they see," she told Joe.
Big Jim's smile froze into a grimace.
"Woman, put that down.
Ask them if they see."
Joe spoke into the phone, listened, then said,
"They do. They're seeing Mr. Rennie and Officer Randolph. Nori says they want to know what's happening."
There was dismay on Randolph's face, fury on Rennie's.
"Who wants to know?" Randolph asked.
Julia said,
"We've set up a live feed to Dippers."
"That sin pit," Big Jim said.
His hands were clenched. Barbie estimated the man was probably 100 pounds overweight, and he grimaced when he moved his right arm, as if he'd strained it. But he looked like he could still hit, and right now he looked mad enough to take a swing. Although whether at him, Julia, or the boy, he didn't know. Maybe Rennie didn't either.
"People have been gathering there since 11:15, she said. "News travels fast."
She smiled, with her head cocked to one side.
"Would you like to wave to your constituency, Big Jim?"
"It's a bluff," Big Jim said.
"Why would I bluff about something so easy to check?"
She turned to Randolph. Call one of your cops and ask them where the big gathering in town is this morning. Then back to Jim again. If you shut this down, hundreds of people will know you closed off their view of an event that vitally concerns them. One their lives may depend on, in fact.
You had no sanction.
Barbie, ordinarily quite good at controlling himself, felt his temper fraying. It wasn't that the man was stupid. He clearly wasn't. And that was exactly what was making Barbie mad. What is your problem exactly? Do you see any danger here? Because I don't. The idea is to set this thing up, leave it broadcasting, then clear out.
If the missile doesn't work, it could cause a panic. Knowing something failed is one thing. Actually seeing it fail is another. They're apt to do any darn old thing.
You have a very low opinion of the people you govern, Selectman. Big Jim opened his mouth to retort. Something like, "And they have justified it time and again," would have been Barbie's guess. But then remembered that a good portion of the town was watching this confrontation on the big screen TV. Possibly in HD.
"I'd like you to wipe that sarcastic smile off your face, Barbara."
"Are we now policing expressions, too?" Julia asked. Scarecrow Joe covered his mouth, but not before Randolph and Big Jim saw the kid's grin and heard the snicker that escaped from between his fingers.
"People," the second lieutenant said, "you had better clear the scene. Time is passing."
"Julia, turn that camera on me," Barbie said. She did so. 16. Dippers had never been so packed, not even at the memorable New Year's Eve show in 2009 featuring the Vatican sex kittens. And it had never been so silent. Over 500 people stood shoulder to shoulder and hip to hip, watching as the camera on Joe's PowerBook Pro did a dizzying 180 and came to rest on Dale Barbara.
"There's my boy," Rose Twitchell murmured and smiled.
"Hello there, folks," Barbie said. And the picture was so good that several people helloed back. "I'm Dale Barbara, and I've been recommissioned as a colonel in the United States Army." A general ripple of surprise greeted this. "The video deal out here on Little Bitch Road is entirely my responsibility, and as you may have gathered, there has been a difference of opinion between myself and Selectman Rennie about whether or not to continue the feed." This time the ripple was louder, and not happy. "We have no time to argue the fine points in command this morning," Barbie continued. "We're going to train the camera on the point where the missile is supposed to hit. Whether or not the broadcast continues is in the hands of your second selectman. If he kills the feed, take it up with him. Thanks for your attention." He walked out of the picture. For a moment, the gathering on the dance floor had a view of nothing but woods. Then the image rotated again, sank, and settled on the floating X. Beyond it, the sentries were packing the last of their gear into two big trucks. Will Freeman, owner and operator of the local Toyota dealership and no friend of James Rennie, spoke directly to the TV.
"Leave it alone, Jimmy. There's gonna be a new selectman in the mill by the end of the week."
There was a general rumble of agreement. The townspeople stood quietly, watching and waiting to see if the current program, both dull and unbearably exciting, would continue, or if the transmission would end. 17. "What do you want me to do, Big Jim?" Randolph asked. He took a handkerchief from his hip pocket and mopped the back of his neck.
"What do you want to do?" Big Jim responded.
For the first time since he'd taken the keys to the Green Chief's car, Pete Randolph thought he would be quite willing to turn them over to someone else. He sighed and said, "I want to let this alone." Big Jim nodded, as if to say, "Be it on your own head." Then he smiled, if, that is, a pulling back of the lips can be so characterized.
"Well, you're the chief."
He turned back to Barbie, Julia, and Scarecrow Joe.
"We've been outmaneuvered, haven't we, Mr. Barbara?"
"I assure you that there's no maneuvering going on here, sir," Barbie said.
"Bull. Pucky. This is a bid for power, pure and simple. I've seen plenty in my time. I've seen them succeed, and I've seen them fail.
He stepped closer to Barbie, still favoring his sore right arm. Up close, Barbie could smell cologne and sweat. Rennie was breathing harshly. He lowered his voice. Perhaps Julia didn't hear what came next, but Barbie did.
You're all in the pot, Sonny. Every cent. If the missile punches through, you win. If it just bounces off, beware me.
For a moment, his eyes, almost buried in their deep folds of flesh but glinting with cold, clear intelligence, caught Barbie's and held them. Then he turned away.
Come on, Chief Randolph. The situation is complicated enough, thanks to Mr. Barbara and his friends. Let's go back to town. We'll want to get your troops in place in case of a riot.
That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard, Julia said.
Big Jim flapped a hand at her without turning around.
Do you want to go to Dipper's, Jim? Randolph asked. We've got time.
I wouldn't set foot in that whore hole, Big Jim said.
He opened the passenger door of the cruiser.
What I want is a nap, but I won't get one, because there's a lot to do. I've got big responsibilities. I didn't ask for them, but I have them.
Some men are great, and some men have greatness thrust upon them. Isn't that so, Jim? Julia asked. She was smiling her cool smile.
Big Jim turned to her, and the expression of naked hate on his face made her fall back a step. Then Rennie dismissed her. Come on, Chief.
The cruiser headed back toward the mill, its lights still flashing in the hazy, oddly summery light.
Phew, Joe said. Scary dude.
My sentiments exactly, Barbie said. Julia was surveying Barbie, all traces of her smile gone.
You had an enemy, she said. Now, you have a blood foe.
I think you do, too.
She nodded.
For both our sakes, I hope this missile thing works.
The second lieutenant said,
Colonel Barbara, we're leaving. I'd feel much more comfortable if I saw you three doing the same.
Barbie nodded, and for the first time in years, snapped off a salute. 18. A B-52, which had taken off from Carswell Air Force Base in the early hours of that Monday morning, had been on station above Burlington, Vermont, since 10:40 hours. The Air Force believes in showing up early for the prom whenever possible. The mission was codenamed Grand Isle. The pilot commander was Major Gene Ray, who had served in both the Gulf and Iraq wars. In private conversations, he referred to the latter as Big W's fuck-a-monkey show. He had two Fast Hawk cruise missiles in his bomb bay. It was a good stick, the Fast Hawk, more reliable and powerful than the old Tomahawk, but it felt very weird to be planning to shoot a live one at an American target. At 12:53, a red light on his control panel turned amber. The COMCOM took control of the plane from Major Ray and began to turn it into position. Below him, Burlington disappeared under the wings. Ray spoke into his headset.
It's just about showtime, sir.
In Washington, Colonel Cox said,
Roger that, Major. Good luck. Blast the bastard.
It'll happen, Ray said.
At 12:54, the amber light began to pulse. At 12:54 and 55 seconds, it turned green. Ray flicked the switch marked 1. There was no sensation, and only a faint whoosh from below. But he saw the Fast Hawk begin its flight on vid. It quickly accelerated to its maximum speed, leaving a jet cone trail like a fingernail scratch across the sky. Gene Ray crossed himself, finishing with a kiss at the base of his thumb.
Go with God, my son, he said.
The Fast Hawk's maximum speed was 3,500 miles an hour. 50 miles from its target, about 30 miles west of Conway, New Hampshire, and now on the east side of the White Mountains, its computer first calculated and then authorized final approach. The missile's speed dropped from 3,500 miles an hour to 1,850 as it descended. It locked on Route 302, which is North Conway's Main Street.
Pedestrians looked up uneasily as the fast hawk passed overhead.
Isn't that jet way too low?
A woman in the parking lot of Settlers Green Outlet Village asked her shopping companion, shading her eyes. If the fast hawk's guidance system could have talked, it might have said, "You ain't seen nothing yet, sweetheart." It passed over the Maine, New Hampshire border at 3,000 feet, trailing a sonic boom that rattled teeth and broke windows. When the guidance system picked up Route 119, it slipped first to 1,000 feet, then down to 500. By now, the computer was in high gear, sampling the guidance system's data and making 1,000 course corrections a minute. In Washington, Colonel James O. Cox said, "Final approach, people. Hang on to your false teeth." The fast hawk found Little Bitch Road and dropped almost to ground level, still blasting at near Mach 2 speed, reading every hill and turn, its tail burning too brightly to look at, leaving a toxic stench of propellant in its wake. It tore leaves from the trees, even ignited some. It imploded a roadside stand in Tarker's Hollow, sending boards and smashed pumpkins flying into the sky. The boom followed, causing people to fall to the floor with their hands over their heads. "This is going to work," Cox thought. "How can it not?" 19. In Dippers, there were now 800 people crammed together. No one spoke, although Lissa Jameson's lips moved soundlessly as she prayed to whatever New Age oversoul happened to be currently claiming her attention. She clutched a crystal in one hand. The Reverend Piper Libby was holding her mother's cross against her lips. Ernie Calvert said, "Here it comes." "Well," Marty Arsenal demanded,
"I don't see nothing."
"Listen," Brenda Perkins said. They heard it come. A growing, otherworldly hum from the western edge of town. A mmm that rose to mmm in a space of seconds. On the big screen TV, they saw almost nothing. Until half an hour later, long after the missile had failed. For those still remaining in the roadhouse, Benny Drake was able to slow the recording down until it was advancing frame by frame. They saw the missile come slewing around what was known as Little Bitch Bend. It was no more than 4 feet off the ground, almost kissing its own blurred shadow. In the next frame, the Fast Hawk, tipped with a blast fragmentation warhead designed to explode on contact, was frozen in midair about where the Marines' bivouac had been. In the next frames, the screen filled with a white so bright it made the watchers shade their eyes. Then, as the white began to fade, they saw the missile fragments, so many black dashes against the diminishing blast, and a huge scorch mark where the red X had been. The missile had hit its spot exactly. After that, the people in Dippers watched the woods on the Tarker's side of the dome burst into flame. They watched the asphalt on that side first buckle, and then begin to melt. 20.
"Fire the other one," Cox said dully, and Gene Ray did. It broke more windows and scared more people in eastern New Hampshire and western Maine. Otherwise, the result was the same. In the frame. 1. At 19 Mill Street, home of the McClatchy family, there was a moment of silence when the recording ended. Then Norrie Calvert burst into fresh tears. Benny Drake and Joe McClatchy, after looking at each other over her bowed head with identical what-do-I-do-now expressions, put their arms around her quaking shoulders and gripped each other's wrists in a kind of soul shake.
"That's it?" Claire McClatchy asked unbelievingly.
Joe's mother wasn't crying, but she was close. Her eyes glistened. She was holding her husband's picture in her hands, had taken it off the wall shortly after Joe and his friends had come in with the DVD.
"That's all?"
No one answered. Barbie was perched on the arm of the easy chair where Julia was sitting. I could be in big trouble here, he thought. But it wasn't his first thought. That had been that the town was in big trouble. Mrs. McClatchy got to her feet. She still held her husband's picture. Sam had gone to the flea market that ran at Oxford Speedway each Saturday until the weather got too cold. His hobby was refinishing furniture, and he often found good stuff at the stalls there. 3 days later, he was still in Oxford, sharing space at the Raceway Motel with several platoons of reporters and TV people. He and Claire couldn't speak to each other on the phone, but had been able to stay in touch by email. So far.
What happened to your computer, Joey? She asked. Did it blow up?
Joe, his arms still around Nori's shoulders, his hands still gripping Benny's wrist, shook his head.
I don't think so, he said. It probably just melted.
He turned to Barbie. The heat might set the woods on fire out there. Someone ought to do something about that.
I don't think there are any fire engines in town, Benny said. Well, maybe one or two old ones.
Let me see what I can do about that, Julia said. Claire McClatchy towered over her. It was easy enough to see where Joe had gotten his height.
Barbie, it would probably be best if I handled this on my own.
Why? Claire looked bewildered. One of her tears finally overspilled and ran down her cheek.
Joe said the government put you in charge, Mr. Barbara, the president himself.
I had a disagreement with Mr. Rennie and Chief Brandolph about the video feed, Barbie said. It got a little hot. I doubt if either of them would welcome my advice just now. Julia, I don't think they'd exactly welcome yours either. At least not yet. If Randolph's halfway competent, he'll send a bunch of deputies out there with whatever's left in the fire barn. At the very least, there'll be hoses and Indian pumps. Julia considered this, then said,
Would you step outside with me for a minute, Barbie?
He looked at Joe's mother, but Claire was no longer paying them any attention. She had moved her son aside and was sitting next to Nori, who pressed her face against Claire's shoulder.
Dude, the government owes me a computer, Joe said as Barbie and Julia walked toward the front door.
Noted, Barbie said, and thank you, Joe. You did well.
A lot better than their damn missile, Benny muttered.
On the front stoop of the McClatchy home, Barbie and Julia stood silent, looking toward the town common, Presteel Stream, and the Peace Bridge. Then, in a voice that was low-pitched and angry, Julia said,
He's not. That's the thing. That's the goddamn thing.
Who's not what?
Peter Randolph is not halfway competent. Not even one quarter. I went to school with him all the way from kindergarten, where he was a world champion pantsweater, to 12th grade, where he was part of the bra-snapping brigade. He was a C-minus intellect who got B-minus grades because his father was on the school board, and his brain power has not increased. Our Mr. Rennie has surrounded himself with dullards. Andrea Grinnell is an exception, but she's also a drug addict. Oxycontin.
Back problems, Barbie said. Rose told me. Enough of the trees on the common had shed their leaves for Barbie and Julia to be able to see Main Street. It was deserted now. Most people would still be at Dipper's discussing what they had seen, but its sidewalks would soon fill with stunned, disbelieving townsfolk drifting back to their homes. Men and women who would not yet even dare ask each other what came next. Julia sighed and ran her hands through her hair.
Jim Rennie thinks if he just keeps all the control in his own hands, things will eventually come right side up. For him and his friends, at least. He's the worst kind of politician. Selfish, too egocentric to realize he's way out of his league, and a coward underneath that bluff can-do exterior of his. When things get bad enough, he'll send this town to the devil if he thinks he can save himself by doing so. A cowardly leader is the most dangerous of men. You're the one who should be running this show.
I appreciate your confidence.
But that's not going to happen, no matter what your Colonel Cox and the President of the United States may want. It's not going to happen even if 50,000 people march down Fifth Avenue in New York waving signs with your face on them. Not with that fucking dome still over our heads.
Every time I listen to you, you sound less Republican, Barbie remarked. She struck him on the bicep with a surprisingly hard fist.
This is not a joke.
No, Barbie said, it's not a joke. It's time to call for elections, and I urge you to stand for second selectman yourself. She looked at him pityingly.
Do you think Jim Rennie is going to allow elections as long as the dome is in place? What world are you living in, my friend?
Don't underestimate the will of the town, Julia.
And don't you underestimate James Rennie. He's been in charge here for donkey's years, and people have come to accept him. Also, he's very talented when it comes to finding scapegoats.
an out-of-towner. A drifter, in fact, would be perfect in the current situation. Do we know anybody like that?
I was expecting an idea from you, not a political analysis.
For a moment, he thought she was going to hit him again. Then she drew in a breath, let it out, and smiled.
You come on all aw-shucks, but you've got some thorns, don't you?
The town hall whistle began to blow a series of short blasts into the warm, still air.
Someone's called in a fire, Julia said. I think we know where.
They looked west, where rising smoke smudged the blue. Barbie thought most of it had to be coming from the Darker's Mills side of the dome, but the heat would almost certainly have ignited small fires on the Chester's side as well.
You want an idea? Okay, here's one. I'll track down Brenda. She'll either be at home or at Dipper's with everyone else, and suggest she take charge of the firefighting operation.
And if she says no?
I'm pretty sure she won't. At least there's no wind to speak of, not on this side of the dome, so it's probably just grass and brush. She'll tap some guys to pitch in, and she'll know the right ones. They'll be the ones Howie would have picked.
None of them new officers, I take it.
I'll leave that up to her, but I doubt if she'll be calling on Carter Thibodeau or Melvin Searles. Freddie Denton, either. He's been on the cops for 5 years, but I know from Brenda that Duke was planning to let him go. Freddie plays Santa every year at the elementary school, and the kids love him. He's got a great ho-ho-ho. He's also got a mean streak.
You'll be going around Rennie again?
Yes.
Payback could be a bitch.
I can be a bitch myself when I have to be. Brenda, too, if she gets her back up.
Go for it, and make sure she asks that guy Burpee. When it comes to putting out a brush fire, I'd trust him rather than any town fire barn leftovers. He's got everything in that store of his.
She nodded. That's a damn good idea.
Sure you don't want me to tag along?
You've got other fish to fry. Did Bren give you Duke's key to the fallout shelter?
She did.
Then the fire may be just the distraction you need. Get that Geiger counter.
She started for her Prius, then stopped and turned back.
Finding the generator, assuming there is one, is probably the best chance this town has got. Maybe the only one. And Barbie?
Right here, ma'am, he said, smiling a little. She didn't.
Until you've heard Big Jim Rennie's stump speech, don't sell him short. There are reasons he's lasted as long as he has.
Good at waving the bloody shirt, I take it.
Yes, and this time the shirt is apt to be yours.
She drove off to find Brenda and Romeo Burpee. 2. Those who had watched the Air Force's failed attempt to punch through the dome left Dippers pretty much as Barbie had imagined. Slowly, with their heads down, not talking much. Many were walking with their arms about one another. Some were crying. 3 town police cars were parked across the road from Dippers, and 6 cops stood leaning against them, ready for trouble. But there was no trouble. The green chief of police car was parked further up, in the front lot of Brownie's store, where a hand-lettered sign in the window read, "Closed until freedom allows fresh supplies." Chief Randolph and Jim Rennie sat inside the car, watching.
"There," Big Jim said with unmistakable satisfaction. "I hope they're happy."
Randolph looked at him curiously.
"Didn't you want it to work?"
Big Jim grimaced as his sore shoulder twinged.
"Of course, but I never thought it would. And that fellow with the girl's name and his new friend Julia managed to get everyone all worked up and hopeful, didn't they?"
"Oh, yes, you bet. Do you know she's never endorsed me for office in that rag of hers? Not one single time."
He pointed at the pedestrian streaming back toward town.
"Take a good look, pal. This is what incompetency, false hope, and too much information gets you. They're just unhappy and disappointed now, but when they get over that, they'll be mad. We're going to need more police."
"More? We've got 18 already, counting the part-timers and the new deputies."
"It won't be enough, and we've got..."
The town whistle began to hammer the air with short blasts. They looked west and saw the smoke rising.
"We've got Barbara and Shumway to thank," Big Jim finished.
"Maybe we ought to do something about that fire."
"It's a Tarker's Mills problem, and the U.S. government's, of course. They started a fire with their cotton
pickin' missile. Let them deal with it. But if the heat sparked one on this side, stop being an old woman and drive me back to town. I've got to find Junior. He and I have things to talk about. 3. Brenda Perkins and the Reverend Piper Libby were in Dipper's parking lot by Piper's Subaru. I never thought it would work, Brenda said. But I'd be a liar if I said I wasn't disappointed.
Me too, Piper said, bitterly. I'd offer you a ride back to town, but I have to check on a parishioner.
Not out on Little Bitch, I hope, Brenda said. She lifted a thumb at the rising smoke.
No, the other way. Eastchester, Jack Evans. He lost his wife on Dome Day, a freak accident. Not that all of this isn't freakish.
Brenda nodded.
I saw him out at Dinsmore's Field, carrying a sign with his wife's picture on it. Poor, poor man.
Piper went to the open driver's side window of her car where Clover was sitting behind the wheel and watching the departing crowd. She rummaged in her pocket, gave him a treat, then said,
Push over, Clove. You know you flunked your last driver's test.
To Brenda, she confided, He can't parallel park worth a damn. The shepherd hopped onto the passenger side. Piper opened the car door and looked at the smoke.
I'm sure the woods on the Tarkers Mills side are burning briskly, but that needn't concern us.
She gave Brenda a bitter smile.
We have the dome to protect us. Good luck, Brenda said. Give Jack my sympathy and my love. I'll do that, Piper said, then drove off.
Brenda was walking out of the parking lot with her hands in the pockets of her jeans, wondering how she was going to get through the rest of the day, when Julia Shumway drove up and helped her with that. 4. The missiles exploding against the dome didn't wake Sammy Bushy. It was the clattery wooden crash, followed by little Walter's screams of pain, that did that. Carter Thibodeau and his friends had taken all of her fridge dope when they left, but they hadn't searched the place, so the shoebox with the rough skull and crossbones drawn on it was still in the closet. There was also this message, printed in Phil Bushy's scrawly, backslanting letters, My shit, touch it, and you die. There was no pot inside. Phil had always sneered at pot as a cocktail party drug, and she had no interest in the baggie of crystal. She was sure the deputies would have enjoyed smoking it, but Sammy thought crystal was crazy shit for crazy people. Who else would inhale smoke that included the residue of matchbook striker pads marinated in acetone? There was another smaller baggie, however, that contained half a dozen dreamboats. And when Carter's posse left, she had swallowed one of these with warm beer from the bottle stashed under the bed she now slept in alone. Except for when she took little Walter in with her, that was. Or Dodie. She had briefly considered taking all of the dreamboats and ending her crappy, unhappy life once and for all. Might even have done it, if not for little Walter. If she died, who would take care of him? He might even starve to death in his crib, a horrible thought. Suicide was out, but she had never felt so depressed and sad and hurt in all her life. Dirty, too. She had been degraded before, God knew, sometimes by Phil, who had enjoyed drug-fueled threesomes before losing interest in sex completely. Sometimes by others, sometimes by herself. Sammy Bushy had never gotten the concept of being her own best friend. Certainly, she'd had her share of one-night stands, and once in high school, after the Wildcats basketball team had won the Class D championship, she had taken on 4 of the starters, one after the other, at a post-game party. The 5th had been passed out in a corner. It had been her own stupid idea. She had also sold what Carter, Mel, and Frankie de Lesseps had taken by force. Most frequently to Freeman Brown, owner of Brownie's store, where she did most of her shopping because Brownie gave her credit. He was old and didn't smell very good, but he was randy, and that was actually a plus. It made him quick. 6 pumps on the mattress in the storeroom was his usual limit, followed by a grunt and a squirt. That was never the highlight of her week, but it was comforting to know that line of credit was there, especially if she came up short at the end of the month and little Walter needed pampers. And Brownie had never hurt her. What had happened last night was different. De Lesseps hadn't been so bad, but Carter had hurt her up top and made her bleed down below. Worse had followed.
When Mel Searles dropped his pants, he was sporting a tulle like the ones she'd sometimes seen in the porno movies Phil had watched before his interest in Crystal overtook his interest in sex. Searles had gone at her hard, and although she tried to remember what she and Doty had done 2 days before, it didn't work. She remained as dry as August with no rain. Until, that was, what Carter Thibodeau had only abraded ripped wide open. Then there was lubrication. She had felt it puddling under her, warm and sticky. There had been wetness on her face, too, tears trickling down her cheeks to nestle in the hollows of her ears. During Mel Searle's endless ride, it came to her that he might actually kill her. If he did, what would happen to little Walter? And weaving through it all, the shrill magpie voice of Georgia Rue. Do her. Do her. Do that bitch. Make her holler. Sammy had hollered all right. She had hollered plenty. And so had little Walter from his crib in the other room. In the end, they had warned her to keep her mouth shut and left her to bleed on the couch. Hurt, but alive. She'd watched their headlights move across the living room ceiling, then fade as they drove away toward town. Then it was just her and little Walter. She had walked him back and forth, stopping just once to put on a pair of underpants, not the pink ones, she never wanted to wear those again, and stuff the crotch with toilet paper. She had Tampax, but the thought of putting anything up there made her cringe. Finally, little Walter's head had fallen heavily on her shoulder, and she felt his drool dampening her skin, a reliable sign that he was really and truly out. She had put him back in his crib, praying that he would sleep through the night. And then she had taken the shoebox down from the closet. The dreamboat, some kind of powerful downer, she didn't know exactly what, had first damped the pain down there, and then blotted out everything. She had slept for over 12 hours. Now this. Little Walter's screams were like a bright light cutting through heavy fog. She lurched out of bed and ran into his bedroom, knowing the goddamn crib which Phil had put together half-stoned had finally collapsed. Little Walter had been shaking the shit out of it last night when the deputies were busy with her. That must have weakened it enough so that this morning when he began stirring around, little Walter was on the floor in the wreckage. He crawled toward her with blood pouring from a cut on his forehead. "Little Walter!" she screamed, and swept him into her arms. She turned, stumbled over a broken crib slat, went to one knee, got up, and rushed into the bathroom with the baby wailing in her arms. She turned on the water, and of course no water came. There was no power to run the well pump. She grabbed a towel and dry-mopped his face, exposing the cut. Not deep, but long and ragged. It would leave a scar. She pressed the towel against it as hard as she dared, trying to ignore little Walter's renewed shrieks of pain and outrage. Blood pattered onto her bare feet in dime-sized drops. When she looked down, she saw the blue panties she'd put on after the deputies had left were now soaked to a muddy purple. At first, she thought it was little Walter's blood, but her thighs were streaked too. 5. Somehow she got little Walter to hold still long enough to plaster 3 SpongeBob Band-Aids along the gash, and to get him into an undershirt and his one remaining clean overall. On the bib, red stitching proclaimed, "Mommy's Lil Devil." She dressed herself while little Walter crawled in circles on her bedroom floor, his wild sobbing reduced to lackadaisical sniffles. She started by throwing the blood-soaked underpants into the trash and putting on fresh ones. She patted the crotch with a folded dish wiper, and took an extra for later. She was still bleeding, not gushing, but it was a far heavier flow than during her worst periods, and it had gone on all night. The bed was soaked. She packed little Walter's go-bag, then picked him up. He was heavy, and she felt fresh pain settle in down there, the sort of throbbing bellyache you got from eating bad food.
"We're going to the health center," she said, "and don't you worry, little Walter. Dr. Haskell will fix us both up. Also, scars don't matter as much to boys. Sometimes girls even think they're sexy. I'll drive as fast as I can, and we'll be there in no time."
She opened the door.
"Everything's gonna be all right."
But her old rust bucket Toyota was far from all right. The deputies hadn't bothered with the back tires, but they had punctured both front ones.
Sammy looked at the car for a long moment, feeling an even deeper depression settle over her. An idea, fleeting but clear, crossed her mind. She could split the remaining dreamboats with little Walter. She could grind his up and put them in